Rosie Schuster. I was hanging with Aykroyd at that point in time, so it was kind of amazing watching the whole scene, the blues bar and everything, take off. It was kind of like boys' fantasies of the blues, and then heavy saturation of the blues, and then, having played out all these different fantasies in TV sketches, suddenly there was this manifestation, and they really inhabited these characters. And you could see that whole thing start to unfold in the blues bar. Some of those parties were pretty intense and wonderful, and just great music and dancing. I remember that really fondly, just watching those characters explode. And it was the end of the week, and, well, you were psyched. It was like you were buzzing. You'd get turbocharged from the intense effort of it, and then there's like adrenaline burnout later. I remember sleeping at the blues bar, you know, as the light broke. Also, probably there were other substances involved besides alcohol, and the party just spilled over. People really had a lot of energy they needed to shake off.
Dan Aykroyd. By the time you're done at 1 o'clock Saturday night, that pump's still going at full race, and you can't just go home and go to bed. So we needed a place to party. And frequently I remember rolling down the armor at the blues bar and closing the building at 11 o'clock Sunday morning, you know, when it was at its height, and saying good morning to the cops and firemen.
Penny Marshall. The blues bar was a zoo, but it was fun. It was people getting famous at the same time, which is always very scary. We held on to each other desperately, because we trusted each other. In hanging out with each other, we knew we weren't going to tell on each other.
Steve Martin. The first time I did the show, there was a fire in the studio. We had to go out to some other studio to do it. The cast was a little upset because they were not in their home world. We had to go to Brooklyn. I remember being very nervous and thinking, oh my God, it's live. It was very tense, but a lot of fun. I ran into Dan early one afternoon, and he was sort of black and blue, and I said, what happened? And he said, oh, I got pushed out of a moving taxi. They were wild, Dan and John. I never went to their bar, the blues bar. I wasn't that kind of guy.
Jane Curtin. I didn't even know where the blues bar was. I sort of stopped going to the after-show parties after the first year, just because they weren't fun. They were strange. I'd just go home.
John Landis. I went up to the SNL offices. John was giving me a tour when a very sexy girl walks by. Tight jeans and a t-shirt, no bra, curly hair. Oh my God, who is that? And John says, that's Rosie Schuster. That's Lauren's wife and Danny's girlfriend. Which is true. It was wild. Rosie's the one who coined the best line about Aykroyd. Danny had studied in a seminary to be a Jesuit priest the same time he was doing second story jobs in and around Ontario. Rosie's the one who said, Danny's epiphany would be to commit a crime and arrest himself. Howard Shore, music director. When the band did warm-ups for the show, some members of the cast wanted to get involved. I knew Danny from Toronto, so I let him do a few things. Then Danny wanted to bring John into it, and I said okay, and I did a couple of things with Danny and John. I used to introduce them as those brothers in blues, the Blues Brothers. I think John looked to us as more serious musicians, something he wanted to be. Dan Aykroyd. When Carrie Fisher did the show, we used the Blues Brothers to warm up the audience, but we had played a couple of times prior to that. We played with Willie Nelson as our backup band, and Mickey Raphael on harp, and Willie Hall, and then the Uniforms at the Lone Star. And then we had Duke Robillard and Room Full of Blues playing behind us as well. We wanted Duke to be our backup man, but he was with Room Full of Blues, and I think he felt that Belushi would dominate, so he kind of backed off that gig. And we ended up recruiting through Tom Malone, the horn player in the SNL band. We ended up getting Steve Cropper and Donald Dunn, and Lou Marini and Alan Rubin, and Matt Murphy. Matt Murphy we found in a bar on Columbus Avenue, and we heard him play. He was playing with James Cotton, and we said, "We want this guy in the band." And then Cropper and Dunn, they had to be convinced, because they weren't sure that we could acquit ourselves to the music. But they saw the respect, the reverence we had, and that we wanted to do a Memphis-Chicago fusion band, which ultimately the Blues Brothers turned out to be, doing Chicago Electrified Blues and Memphis Stax R&B, and that was our set. They came on, and we did the first appearances with Carrie Fisher and then with Steve Martin. John Landis. Lorne was hysterical that Chevy was making a movie, and he refused to give me Danny for the part of D-Day in Animal House. He refused. He wouldn't release Danny, and he told him, "You have to be here and write, or I'm going to fire you." He threatened Danny, and it was ugly. And by the way, that's what happened on the Blues Brothers later, which is he wouldn't release Paul Schaefer, who was a member of the band, who was the star who put the band together. As the stakes got higher, the atmosphere at SNL grew more fractious. Actors fought for airtime and for the attention of writers. After Chevy Chase's Ascent, and then Belushi's, appearances on the show came to be looked upon by many performers as auditions for movie careers, as if the show itself were no longer the object all sublime. Many of those who were there for those first 5 gold standard years look back not in regret but in rueful resignation, or a kind of pained joy. Some had required chemical stimulation merely to maintain the show's mind-bending schedule, working through the night, especially Wednesday and Thursday nights, and virtually living in the building. Taking a cue from Dan Aykroyd and his office bunk beds, Ann Beats famously demanded that the network install a hospital bed in her office during a contract negotiation, and got her wish. They and their cohorts were not just the staff of a TV show. They were still a commune, a subculture, and most of all, a family. Sadly, the family was splitting asunder. That became evident when the prodigal prankster Chevy Chase returned to host a show. His stint as host set a new ratings record for SNL, but behind the scenes he was not warmly embraced.
Jane Curtin. My husband and I had tickets to the ballet, and I had on my best clothes, and Lorne called about 10 minutes before we were leaving to go uptown and said, "I need to talk to you. Can you come up to 30 Rock? I said, "We have tickets to the ballet." And he said, "It will only take a minute." So I went up there, and Chevy proceeded to say that he thought he should be doing update that week. And I said, "Okay," and then he went through this whole thing about how his fans wanted to see him. I said, "Okay." And Lorne was backing him up and backing him up, and I'm going, "Okay, okay." They were expecting a fight, and I honestly didn't care because it was just 1 week and I wanted to leave. I wanted to go to the ballet. But they had to make their point. So we were late. The two of them were on this feeding frenzy in the sense that Chevy was expecting something that he wasn't getting from me. And he became more intent on selling his point of view, and then Lorne would jump in. And you have pieces of your arm bitten off, and then you leave. But it heals. It grows back.
Chevy Chase, cast member. It was difficult the first year I went back to host, because I went back feeling that I was still part of the family there, and at the same time feeling probably, in retrospect, full of myself because I had become pretty famous. And I think that I had never really realized how envious John had become of me, or had been while I was on the show. In fact, it was Lorne who verified that for me later on, that John had been pretty upset that I had become the star and not him, even though I told John many times that it was because I said my name every week, because others couldn't pronounce his or spell it. And it would happen for him, that these things were more luck than talent or ability, and that, of course, he should have been the star. And that he could become one, you know, albeit dead later on. But what the hell, who knew? I wish he were around today. So that first time I came back, 2 things were at work. One was my feeling that if I were to come back, the audiences would really want to see me do a fall, and they'd want to see me do Weekend Update. That was somewhat egocentric of me, because Jane had been doing it all year. It was not thoughtful in that sense, I think, in retrospect again. But in any case, John had also, as I later found out, been spreading some pretty apocryphal stories about me out of his jealousy and anger or whatever to Billy Murray, who was protective of Jane and also, generally speaking, a feisty fellow. And I'm sure Billy wanted to take me down, you know? So Billy and I got into a kind of a preliminary fist fight that never really came to fruition, but came close, and it happened just before I went on the air. It was not very good timing. That was painful for me. In a sense, John caused that fight with Billy, but we both ended up hitting John by mistake. Billy was out of line. I'd been out of line to some degree, certainly in Billy's mind, initiated by the things that Lorne later told me about. So Billy came after me and tried to throw me off a little bit just before I was going on the air. Ultimately, Billy's still Billy and I'm still me, but it didn't faze me for the show. I was sure upset, but I noticed John when I was going into Billy's dressing room, and John was like the Cheshire Cat, sitting there like mission accomplished. I felt at the time I was a lot tougher kid than maybe Billy or anybody might have thought. I had grown up on the edge of East Harlem. I had been in a lot of fistfights, and I didn't feel like anybody could take me, Billy Murray or anybody else for that matter. And so, as intimidating as he can be, at the time I just let it pass. I was angry and I just let it go, thinking, big deal, this happened, but I've got a show to do. Others might have withered. I had a certain tensile strength about me from childhood, with an older brother who had already kicked the crap out of me through much of my younger life. And there'd been a number of times when I was in violent situations, so it wasn't as if I was simply some guy who had never seen the other side of the tracks. I had. And so I guess I simply weathered it. In other words, rather than be filled with the adrenaline that gives you the shakes and doesn't allow you to concentrate on what you're doing, that simply passed. And it may be because I was in shape and I played a lot of soccer and had been in situations where I could calm down readily after something like that happened. I think Billy was trying to take me down a rung, and I was probably up a rung. I was probably a little too full of myself, you know? I realized when I left that maybe I hadn't been such a great guy. Maybe we weren't so close. Maybe I'd been somewhat of an asshole. I left with self-doubts, and as time went on, it was a little easier to do it over the years, because, you know, it was water under the bridge. But it did change my perception, because my perception had been, all along, that that first year was really a tight, close-knit family, and that I just happened to emerge because of something someone had written and because people were responding to me as the first breakaway star. Bill Murray. I got in a fight with Chevy the night he came back to host. That was because I was the new guy, and it was sort of like it was my job to do that. It would have been too petty for someone else to do it. It's almost like I was goaded into that. You know, I think everybody was hoping for it. I did sense that. I think they resented Chevy for leaving, for one thing. They resented him for taking a big piece of the success and leaving and making his own career go. Everybody else was from the improvisational world, where you didn't make it about you. You were an ensemble. You were a company. So when he left, there was resentment about that. It was a shock. At the same time, Chevy was the big potato in the stew. He got the most sketches, he had the most influence, he got the most publicity, all of those things. So they didn't miss that part of it. But there was still a hangover feeling that he shouldn't have left until everybody had that. You make sure everybody else is there, and then you do it. It did leave a big vacuum because he was really heavy in those shows, and so you had a whole year where the writers ended up writing, like writers do. They write for the guys who can get it done, who can get it on the air. And Chevy's sketches got on the air because he was the man, you know. The other actors had to start over from scratch and teach the writers how to write it for them. They were new people who had to be written for, but they weren't new people. They'd been there all year. They just hadn't gotten on. So the show had to sort of start up again from the beginning without him. I remember just sort of a general animosity that they felt, and he did come back as a star. When you become famous, you've got like a year or two where you act like a real asshole. You can't help yourself. It happens to everybody. You've got like 2 years to pull it together, or it's permanent. John Landis. I've only been to SNL 3 times, and one time I was there, Chevy and Billy were having a huge screaming fight in the hallway, and Michael O'Donohue and Tom Davis were holding them back, and John and Danny jumped in because Chevy and Billy were really going to come to blows. I mean, it was a huge argument. And the thing I remember about Bill Murray, I don't know Bill Murray, but he's screaming, you know, foaming at the mouth, "Fucking Chevy!" And in anger, he says, "Medium talent!" And I thought, oh boy, that's funny. In anger, he says, "medium talent." That really impressed me. I went, so, Bill Murray. Wow, who is that guy?
Lorraine Newman. It seems like there was a tension between Chevy and Billy all along during the week. I don't know why. I don't know if Chevy provoked it or not. But it culminated with Billy saying to Chevy, "Why don't you fuck your wife once in a while?" And I don't even remember who threw the first punch, Billy or Chevy. But it was ugly. I'd never seen guys fighting like that, let alone people I knew. And you know, I don't know how he did it, but Chevy went out and did the monologue a few minutes later. Watching him from the floor, he seemed shattered.
Lorne Michaels. Billy Joel, the musical guest, was out there singing his heart out while all this was going on backstage. Alan Zweibel. There had come a point in the first season where Chevy wasn't writing for the show as much as he was writing for Chevy, and that didn't help things. I can't put it in the degree of who was despised more or whatever. I know that when he left the show and he did the specials, there were some interviews with him where he was talking about the future of Saturday Night Live, the show that he had just left. And I seem to remember him being quoted as saying things like, "I've used that show for everything I can. That show has no future other than to get weirder as opposed to smarter." As if the first year we'd just shot our wad. Those were the kinds of things that were coming back to us. And so those of us who were still in the coal mines, shoveling 7 days a week, had to ask, "Why are you doing this? We worked really hard with you and for you." That made no sense. I remember Chevy coming back after one of his specials and talking about it or raving about it, you know, proud of something he just did. And I remember Al Franken saying something like, "That's good, Chevy, but we do one of those every week." So there were some ill feelings, I think. In those first 5 years, Saturday Night Live not only had its best cast ever, but also the best and ballsiest collection of writers. The sketch form was older than television itself, but the way they approached it, bent it, and shaped it was their own, and it resulted in sketches that are remembered vividly to this day by the first generation of SNL viewers, such recurring classics as the Coneheads, the swinging immigrant Czech brothers, romantic nerds Lisa and Todd, the Greek diner where all one could order was cheeseburger, cheeseburger, and such beloved or notorious sketches as Danny Aykroyd's hemorrhaging Julia Child, his virtuoso performance as the immortal Bass-O-Matic Pitchman, the violent and controversial Stunt Baby, Buck Henry as pedophilic babysitter Uncle Roy, and the hilariously businesslike comportment of Aykroyd as Fred Garvin, male prostitute. Steve Martin. When you're young, you have way fewer taboo topics, and then as you go through life, and you have experiences with people getting cancer and dying and all the things you would have made fun of, then you don't make fun of them anymore. So rebelliousness really is the province of young people, that kind of iconoclasm. Dan Aykroyd. Michael O'Donohue was one of the really great writers on the show, and he really taught me how to write for television. He taught me to have the confidence. He taught me to go with the concept, to embrace the absurdity. He taught me structure. He was meticulous in the way he laid out structure bits. He taught me the discipline of writing for television.
Lily Tomlin, host. I enjoyed hosting. At least I think I did. I do remember that after the show got to be such a big hit, I hosted it again. By that time, I just remember everybody, not everybody, but people like Michael O'Donohue, was a little bit manic. The dress rehearsal did not go well. And Michael was so eccentric, and he must have been so angry with me. He was like putting the evil eye on me or something. And it was so kind of ludicrous that I burst out laughing. It was so important to them at that point, because they were creating that show and getting it off the ground and everything, so that was their identity. And I can understand their intensity, their wanting it to be this or that or great or whatever, and being put out with someone. I think I was forgiven. Carrie Fisher. I was around Michael O'Donohue until he was deeply offended that I married Paul Simon, and his ex-girlfriend was maid of honor, and he wasn't in the wedding, and he never spoke to me again. I went up to him again at some point and said, "Can't we put this aside?" He just screamed at me. It was horrible. But I loved Michael. Michael and I had gone to Ireland together, and I think we were actually the first people to do Lewds and Mead. I was shooting the Star Wars movies, and John and Danny wanted to be in them as space creatures or something. I think it was mostly John.
Dan Aykroyd. I was never proprietary about pieces. Look, if a piece didn't work, you know, please get it out, and let's do what works for the show. Let's put someone else's piece in there. But I had a lot of strength behind me, because I had Franken and Davis and Downey and O'Donohue as my co-writers, and oftentimes we'd come in and there'd be three or four of us real strong writers, and so we knew we were going to get on. The goods had been created.
Lorraine Newman. Lorne urged me to repeat characters. I refused to do it because I wanted to, you know, dazzle everybody with my versatility. And that kept me anonymous. It was the same pitfall for Danny. He was much more comfortable doing characters, and I think that made him less recognizable than John, who was always John even when he was the samurai. And Billy was always Billy. He did Todd and the Nerds, but basically he was Billy. So even though I loved the kind of work that I did, and still do, I love the character work, I think it keeps you more anonymous than people who play themselves.
Buck Henry, host. I never had a problem with repeating characters, saying, "Oh, we've done enough Coneheads," or that we had done enough of, you know, anything that worked. I thought, why not keep going and doing it? You would only stop it if you had a concept that didn't live up to the characters. Then you would say, "Oh, this is not strong enough for the characters, and we can't do this." Don Novello, writer. I wrote the Greek restaurant sketch the second week I was there. It's like a hit song, I guess, in a way. The restaurant is called Billy Goat's. I used to go down there all the time to this Billy Goat tavern. I worked in advertising then, just to hear these guys going, "Cheeseburger, cheeseburger, cheeseburger." It's still there. They've really played it up. They have a sign outside, "Cheeseburger, cheeseburger." It's on some Chicago tour. They drop by. And they opened a few other places. They sell them at the stadium, but it's always, "Cheeseburger, cheeseburger." They play it up big. The people at the diner recognized it right away on the show. It was a big thing to do at the time. We had a live grill there, a working grill. They were really making cheeseburgers. I'd say we did 6, 7, 8 of those sketches. Brian Doyle Murray. Don Novello and I came in at the same time, and we got put in a former storeroom that abutted the elevator shaft. You could barely hear because of the noise from the elevator shaft. There were no windows. That's where we started out. And they were trying to make us work together. And then when he wrote that cheeseburger, cheeseburger thing, he got a decent office. The next year I got a decent office, after I did a series of, like, Knights of Columbus meetings, which introduced the character of Garrett Morris's Chico Escuela. Garrett Morris, cast member. Chico was my favorite, but I also really liked, "I'm gonna get me a shotgun and kill all the whiteys I see." Now that was when we were improvising. Lorne actually said, "Look, I want to do a thing called the Death Row Follies. You be a prisoner, you be so-and-so, you be so-and-so. Go away and come back with something." That's what we did. See, I liked it when they did it like that, even though I was desperately learning the technique that these guys were masters at. John and Gilda particularly. I'm the kind of guy, throw me out there, I don't give a shit. I knew I could always react to your ass. A lot of stuff on Saturday Night Live was really my kind of stuff, because I like to do stuff that's really new and exploratory. If stuff was on the line, either racially or sexually, I didn't give a damn. If you want to try it, let's try it. James Signorelli. If we gave every sketch that anybody ever complained about not having an ending, the show would fail. I don't think people say that as a criticism. I think they just say it. Bill Murray. Danny was the best at saving sketches when things were really deadly, when things were really dying. When you're dying, you just play for yourself. Let's make ourselves laugh. If we're not making them laugh, let's start over again and just make ourselves laugh. And that fearlessness would then turn the audience. When people talk about the old cast versus the later casts, I think that was the one thing that our group had. We had that training, so there were more tricks. We'd learned working together as a group in a service way. Nowadays, there's probably more stand-ups that end up on the show, sort of more individual guys than there used to be, and they're individually good, but they maybe don't have that particular skill or training or as much experience in that area. I think the old cast made bad sketches work, or made sketches that were incomplete work. You were always in process, you were always in play. You weren't trying to get the laugh on that line. You were always seeing, like, a bigger movement of the whole sketch and the other characters in it. And you were watching them and trying to make them look good. That was another thing we learned, that you make the other person look good and then you don't have to worry about how you come off. Make the other people look good and you'll be fine. Sometimes there'd be sketches that would be incomplete and the writers may have never found how to make it work, and maybe we didn't even figure out the literary resolution of the sketch precisely. But in the performance of it, you managed to shape a roundness, a completeness, the wholeness of it. And if you were alert in the middle of the scene, you'd see, okay, now these people are really fully developed as much as we're going to do, and now this character will drive the resolution of it, and these characters will satisfy it enough. That was what we did. Dan Aykroyd. If you look at Carol Burnett or your show of shows with Sid Caesar, they rely on something to take you out of it, so that whenever you have a great ending, you've got a great piece. We struggled with the endings, yeah, and they were probably the hardest part of the sketch. I think the ending to a movie is hard, the ending to a television show, the ending to anything is tough. You kind of want to wrap everything up with a bow and button it all up and hark back to what you've done before and end on a high note or a great joke. And that's not always possible. James Signorelli. Nobody really understood what Lorne's contribution was, which was integral to the whole thing, not only in selecting the people, but in creating an atmosphere where people could endure the pressure, and where the pressure was in fact a good thing. A cumulative pressure with a release. And that rhythm, you know, that kind of, I don't know what to compare it to, but that rhythm is what kept the show going, because everybody could start, rush, peak, and crash, and then start again. Dan Aykroyd. Fred Garvin, Male Prostitute, was developed in the lab. That started with me doing guys I'd seen up in Canada, the local tire salesman, whatever. And then when I was living with Rosie, I used to do that at home with her, you know? As part of our love life, that character would emerge. And she said, we have to do this. So we wrote it up. It started in the bedroom, you know, come here, little lady. I do that with my wife today and still get a laugh. No sex, but a laugh. Paul Schaefer, musician. I wrote a piece with Marilyn Miller about Shirley Temple being named an ambassador. And the idea of the sketch was Shirley Temple bringing the leaders of two warring nations together by going into an old-fashioned Shirley Temple song. And that worked. And Marilyn went to Lorne and said, Paul should have a position on the show as a guy who writes this kind of material. Lorne agreed and put me on. But the credit was a problem, because the traditional credit is special musical material. This worried us because it sounded, as we said then, to Carol Burnett. We loved Carol Burnett, we respected her, but we were trying to be different than that. Dan Aykroyd. On the Little Chocolate Donuts parody, that was a Franken and Davis thing that John didn't want to do. His vanity sort of got in the way there. But ultimately, as with all of us, once the writers presented their concept, you could see the merit in it right away, and sometimes you'd go, well, it may not make me look great, or it is not my humor, but this is going to work, and this is going to be funny. James Signorelli. Belushi had been a high school athlete, and he didn't really want to do the sketch. The thing was not whether John thought he could do it. The thing was that John was in his recalcitrant stage. Ann Beats was along on that ride, too. At one point, John is supposed to jump over a bar like a track star. John insisted that he would do the stunt himself. All we did was put some cardboard cartons with blankets over them on the other side of the bar, and the bar was only a couple feet high. I got down as low as I could get with the camera, you know, the widest lens I could get, and so John jumped over this table and landed on the couch, okay? We did it once for practice and again to refine some element. The second time he did it, he screamed out in pain, and he tensed up in his most melodramatic way. He clenched his knee to his chest, and everybody ran over, and John goes, "Get me an ambulance! Get me a medic!" John wanted to be taken to the hospital. He was absolutely not going to do this thing. He was, you know, crippled for life. He was mad at all of us. And Anne went in and smoothed that over with him and got him to go back and finish. John, at that point, was just, you know, feeling his oats. At the end of the spot, he's at the breakfast table. John comes on the set wearing a green crewneck lamb's wool sweater, and he's supposed to look like Bruce Jenner, right? And a shirt with a button-down collar. He insisted that was how he should look. And there's a huge moth hole in the front of the sweater and a white shirt underneath. So I made him wear it backwards. If you look at it again, you'll see he's wearing the sweater backwards. And of course he wanted to smoke a cigarette, but he couldn't for the life of him figure out how to smoke and take a bite of the donut at the same time. So finally we came up with this awkward solution where John holds the cigarette in his hand, takes a puff, then, "I like a good breakfast," and picks up the donut and the cigarette in the same hand. Al Franken. Julia Child came from Tom Davis, having seen her cut herself on the Today Show. I had written the sketch for Walter Matthau, but it didn't get picked the week he hosted. So I had to convince Aykroyd to do it. We tried it once, but we didn't have the hose working properly the first week, so we held it until we got control of the blood spurting. And it's really a consummate Danny performance. I mean, it's live TV, and just the timing of the spurts, it's beautiful. I was so admiring of that performance. It was in the right hands. Walter Matthau wouldn't have been able to handle the technical aspect nearly as well. Danny and I had a good relationship, and I always felt that if I cared about something enough, he would do it. You can only call those in so many times. You've got to be sure about something in order to say, do it. Or you've got to be thinking at least it's worth trying, worth the risk. That's when you feel good. When you make somebody do Julia Child and it turns out the way it did, then you've got some credibility for the next time you want to make him do something. It's always a tug and pull of how much direction you can give somebody, how much they trust you, how much they don't, how much they trust their own instincts, the mood they're in. It depends on the cast member. You have to know each cast member to get the best work that you can out of them. Steve Martin. I think Lorne was reluctant to have me on. I was never reluctant. I wanted to be on the show from the first moment I saw it. But it was one of those timing curves where, when the first show hit the air, I was not, you know, popular enough to really host it. Then there was a synchronicity in my rise to stand-up and records, and we sort of hit at the same moment. In a strange way, I was new and old-fashioned at the same time. And maybe the irony of my performance hadn't reached Lorne yet. I really don't know. Lorne's been one of my oldest friends and oldest supporters, so whatever you feel about somebody at first really doesn't matter. I found that in performers, and sometimes movies, and especially art, that it takes a while to come to something that's new. And a lot of times, when the resistance finally turns to acceptance, it makes you a greater supporter of it or them.
Gene Demanian, associate producer. Nobody wanted to put Steve Martin on the show. I'd seen him on The Tonight Show several times, and I kept trying to get them to let Steve do the show because I thought he was so funny. But, you know, the writers also wanted to be on the show. They said, "He's our same age. If he could do the show, we could do the show." I remember somebody falling out, and I remember running into Lorne and saying, "Lorne, give this guy a chance. He's really, really good." Lorne was reluctant to have him on, but when he finally did, Steve's manager sent me a dozen roses. I was just so thrilled.
Dan Aykroyd. The Czech brothers were, I guess, a combination, a grafting of characters. Steve had this character, the continental guy, and I had the Czech expatriate, the swinging Czech who was trying to talk like an American, trying to be an American, trying to have the inflection in the accent, the clothes. And so we took his continental guy and my Czech guy, and we fused them into the Czech brothers. That's essentially what happened there.
Marilyn Suzanne Miller. I did something kind of different from other people. I started writing these things which they called in those days Marilyn pieces, which were pieces about either men and women or dramatic pieces, the most notable one of which I did with Belushi and Sissy Spacek, for which I won the Emmy. The pieces were like dramatic, and they came from the tradition of those Richard Pryor Lily Tomlin sketches that weren't about the jokes, but were about the character builds, and were often kind of bittersweet. One day Danny came to me and said, "Okay, you know those guys that come over and paw you, and they used to be an engineer in Poland, and now they drive a Camaro?" And I said, "Yes." So he and Steve Martin kind of talked like them and left. And then I wrote the sketch, including that patois they use. "I will put my hands on your big American breasts."
Steve Martin. At that point, I was doing "I'm a Wild and Crazy Guy," and I said, "That's the only act I have, Wild and Crazy Guy." So I did my thing that I was doing on stage. Danny's was actually the more authentic character. And it was funny, because when we rehearsed it during the week, it seemed so funny to us, so funny. And we went on with it, and it seemed to go fine. It wasn't anything special. But we decided to do it again. And for some reason, when we did it the second time, the audience was prepped. It stuck in their heads or something, and they were right there cheering and laughing and going overboard. Between the first time we did it and the second time we did it, something gelled or happened. The crazy walk was something that was supposed to indicate coolness. Bill Murray. The original Nick the Lounge Singer sketch was one that I walked into the read-through. They'd read all the sketches for the week, and I said, "Oh, I have one more." I had never written really anything, and I was just dying on the vine, because, like I said, as the new guy, I was pretty much the second cop through the door every week, the second FBI guy, whatever. Danny was always kind enough to write me in as the second something. No one else even bothered. That was my lifestyle. Then, I don't know, something happened, and somebody gave me this shower soap thing in the shape of a microphone, and I took off with it and wrote this sketch. But basically, it wasn't even written. It was half-written. I started doing it at the read-through, and you're supposed to have a copy of the script for everyone. You're supposed to duplicate them for the entire crew. But I was the only one with a copy. I just started doing it, and I was getting huge laughs. And then I said, "I haven't finished the ending yet." Well, there was this silence. This bone-crushing silence. And Tom Davis said, "I would love to help Bill finish writing that sketch, Lorne." And it was the grandest gesture of, like, this son of a bitch needs this badly, and you know I can make sure he gets it done. At that point, it had gotten a lot of laughs, so it was like, okay. So Davis helped me finish that sketch. That was the shower mic sketch. And then we started writing all the Nicks. Paul Schaefer. Billy decided to do a version of the kind of character that he'd been doing in Chicago, Nick the Lounge Singer. And of course I would be the pianist, but I also got to participate in the writing of it with Billy, Tom Davis, and Danny. Danny would always make an appearance in it as an Indian guy. At ski resorts in Canada, there were always guys like that who operated the chairlift, and they always found a dead animal in the sewage system or something. And that was his appearance. Marilyn Miller was also instrumental in writing this. Billy's performance was so over the top, it almost superseded the writing. We did 5 or 6 of them, I'm just guessing. They always had to come from Billy, and I never knew what his criteria were, but whatever he wanted to do was just right. Star Wars, of course, was his idea. But then we would collaborate on the lyrics once he got the idea. Most of it came from him, though.
Rosie Schuster. I wrote a lot of Gilda's first sketches. Like, I did the first Emily Latella, I did the first Roseanne Rosanna Dana before she had a name. I did a lot of the Baba Wawas, and I did all the Todd and Lisas. I watched every one of those on the live show because I loved it so much, and it just didn't seem like it had been done the same way at Dress or even, you know, a couple times before. It just seemed so amazingly live and raw. Penny Marshall. Gilda went with Paul Simon. She also went out with Billy. One night I was about to see Billy and he said, "I'm no good, ask Gilda." He was drinking, you know. Everyone went through their periods of bad behavior.
Andrew Smith, writer. I remember there was this wonderful Puerto Rican maid that Gilda had based the character of Emily Latella on. She was a lovely, lovely gal and very small. She actually became a great friend, and we used to play tricks on her and chase her down the hall. But she was afraid to come into my office and clean, because my office used to be Garrett Morris's, and that's where he used to freebase. She was afraid to come in, since that was where fire was. So for a long time, my office never got cleaned, until I assured her it was totally safe to come in.
Lorraine Newman. Billy and Gilda's relationship didn't really affect me, except that I can remember them coming to read through and fighting. And she was furious with him, and she'd just told him not to talk to her, and he'd be begging her, and this would be acted out in front of all of us. Jane Curtin. Billy and Gilda? When you're changing clothes backstage right next to two people who are involved, oh yeah, you know what's going on between those two people.
Bill Murray. Lisa Loupner was a great character for Gilda because she could actually laugh inside of it. That sketch was all about making her laugh. There was a lot of extra in that. Those sketches were always tragically overwritten. They couldn't edit worth a damn, and they wouldn't edit. It was a turn for both of us because she had this thing that was so extreme that you could throw anything at it and it would hit the mark, partly because she was such a bright target and partly because of the way she reacted to it. You never saw nerds enjoying themselves before. No one ever saw nerds enjoy themselves, really get funny. You never saw what really tickled them. This was before the Revenge of the Nerds movies. I played a nerd, and Gilda played a nerd, and I was going after her personally, whatever it was, and it made her laugh, and it made all the stuff so incredibly stupid. The fact that even nerds had stupid humor. It was a blast. It was really a blast to do. But they would never edit the stuff, never cut the stuff. And I'd say, "Look, the sketch is running 8 minutes. It's never going to go. Can't we just cut some stuff?" And they'd never cut it. And finally, between Dress and Air, Lorne would say, "You've got to take 2 minutes and 15 seconds out of that sketch." And we'd already figured out what was wrong with it, so we'd never even committed to the stuff we didn't like. So they'd be there doing all these cue card things and saying, "Here, I've got the new changes." And we're like, "Yeah, sure, whatever." We already knew what the hell was going to go. Both Gil and I knew what was working and what wasn't, so we never got attached to the garbage part of the sketch, the thing that was going to be gone. But we still had to rehearse the damn thing for hours and hours and hours. Pulling my pants up as Todd, that was my skill. I remember guys that I knew that were like that. You stick your belly out through your pants, your belt's over your belly, it's sort of like you have your emotional armor in your belly, and you're banging at people with your armor. You go at people with that emotional armor. You lead with it. Rather than being attacked first, you sort of lead with that belly. And it was great to have it with Gilda, because her body was this other thing with these crazy, goofy shoulders and stuff, and she was like almost getting hit from behind all the time in the back of the neck. You'd get the feeling like somebody was thudding her with a mallet or something.